spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
My name is Don Nolan. This is Keeping the Faith. Steve is not with us this afternoon. In fact, Steve's going to be gone for a long, well-deserved vacation to Alaska. And we wish him well on his journey. And today we're going to be talking about values, voters, issues. And we have two guests with us, Senator Michael Frerichs, who happens to be in Denver as we speak. He is our local state senator. Mike, are you there?
Yes, greetings from the Mile High City.
Thank you for being with us. It was wonderful for you to join us. I hope we're not inconveniencing you too much.
No, I spoke with Steve about this. I was very happy to be on his program. Unfortunately, when I scheduled, I didn't realize I would be in Denver at this time. But happy that we can do this by cell phone.
Well, you seem to be coming in loud and clear, even though it's a cell phone. So we'll try not to keep you too long because I know you've got lots of other activities coming up, and it's going to be getting busy in Denver pretty soon, right?
Yes.
All right.
We have a lot of receptions going on this evening, and a lot of my colleagues are eager to talk to me about who the next Senate president is going to be.
Well, let me introduce our other guest here, and we'll get to our topic shortly here. We are also very grateful to have the Reverend Dr. Carol Richards, who happens to be chaplain at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Richards.
Glad to be here.
Dr. Richards is a longtime chaplain. I think you said 40 years?
Well, not at the one place, but overall, yes.
Overall, and he's got some very interesting stories to tell us. And he and I had a very interesting conversation yesterday in Springfield at the Barack Obama celebration. All right, we're going to talk about today values, voters, issues in connection with the Democratic Party. This is a call-in show. If you'd like to call in and speak one of our guests and you're local, call 333-9455. That's the same as 333-WILL. Once again, that's 333-9455 if you have a question for either one of our guests this afternoon. If you want to call out of the area, it's 1-800-222-9455. Well, Michael, let's just go ahead and get started. Just a quick question. I understand that the state senate president office is up for grabs, and you are not in the running. Is that right?
You have heard correctly, but I think everyone who is in the running is here at the convention, and I've already had a couple of conversations with people trying to convince me why they'll be a great Senate president.
Yes, I bet. I've heard there's been probably more than one that's interested, right?
Yes, there are more than one, but only two today so far. But I've received several calls, and that is going to be for an exciting fall. I think we have a lot of interest going on in Illinois politics, and leading off at the top of the ticket, the reason I'm here in Denver, is Barack Obama.
There you go. All right. Well, let's just get right to our topic here. We know you've got to take off here in a few minutes. What are the what does a values voter mean to you, and what are the issues that we're going to be facing at the convention?
Well, I think the convention you're going to have a fairly unified front, but this term values voter was really big after the last presidential election, and Democrats lost because most pollsters said people voted on values, and people took that to mean that the Republicans won this issue because they were the party of values. But I think there weren't a lot of pollsters who asked that next question, what do you mean by values? And John Zogby was one of the pollsters who did this and found out that there is a wide variety of values people vote on. It's not all about abortion, guns, and gays. Mm-hmm. There are values voters who think that not going to war is a moral issue. Not giving tax breaks for the rich and helping the poor mm-hmm. is a moral value. And I think that the reason Democrats, if they lost on that issue, and I'm not sure they did, but if they lost, it's because we didn't do a good job of talking about our morals. We didn't do a good job of convincing people that we have things we stand for. And too often, as Democrats, we're afraid to talk about those things.
I assume you're aware of Thomas Frank's book that came out about a little before 2004, What's Wrong with Kansas?
Yes, I am.
He seems
it's been,
to.
It's been a while since I've read it, but he sort of hit the nail on the head.
He seemed to think the conflict between economic and moral values was the primary problem, particularly for voters on the Republican side. And I've heard some commentators recently suggest that that's not an issue, that things are changing. Is that your perception, that economic and moral issues are beginning to merge?
Well, you know, I think that economic issues are more in the forefront as we have bad economic times. Although if you look back to 2004, you know, we had a president, the first president since Hoover, to preside over an overall loss in jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And yet somehow he was able to pull up election in 2004. I think things have changed somewhat, but I don't think that we as Democrats can get excited and say we're going to win this just because of changes in the economy. We still need to tell the American public what it is we stand for, where we're grounded, where, you know, what our faith is and how that defines our actions.
Mike,
we should run and hide from some of those things. We should be afraid, not afraid to tell them that it's our faith that is a source for opposition to war, and it's the reason we want to help those who are least fortunate in our country.
Mike, we have a call here. Hold on just 1 second. Line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I'm calling from Champaign, and I have been a lifelong Democrat and just really believe in the Democratic Party and the principles of the Democratic Party. And I know that the Democrats hold the governor's office and a majority in both the Illinois House and the Illinois Senate. And I was totally appalled by the cavalier way the House and the Senate representatives voted to give Illinois Power a huge increase in price. And you know, there was talk of maintaining the freeze, and I don't know what happened. Did Illinois Power just pass around a lot of money? Did Emil Jones, who seemed to be the most vocal person against it, did he have that much sway? And, you know, frankly, I was so distressed that for the first time, I considered voting for if there were a Green Party representative in my Senate and legislative district.
Well, thank you for your call. Mike, you have a response?
Sure. You know, I think that Senate President Jones had an awful lot of control by the timing of that issue. But there was an awful lot of debate, discussion. Originally, there was going to be a much larger increase in electric rates. And I think that Democrats in the House and the sat down and worked out something that ultimately ended up in an increase, but not nearly as great an increase. And I think that we'd had rate freeze in place for 10 years. You've seen inputs for the cost of electricity, whether that be coal or oil, have gone up dramatically in that time. And so I realized that people, many people were hurt by the increased cost, people who are living on fixed incomes, and it was very difficult for them. But we tried to provide some rate relief while at the same time making sure that the utility companies could actually operate, because I know we'd like to have deliver cheap power and energy for people throughout the state of Illinois. But at the same time, we'd like to make sure that they do receive that. And if the power companies can't recover their costs for energy, then they're not going to be in business very long. And ultimately, power companies shutting down or going bankrupt is not in the best interest of people of Illinois.
I suppose some would say this is a little off the topic of values voters. On the other hand, for Democrats, almost all issues have to do with values of some sort, right, Mike?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a complicated issue. It's something we spent several months talking about, but it does reflect values voters. I do think that the other party, the claims to be the party of values, in general has supported unfettered capitalism, and that produces winners and it produces a lot of losers. I think the Democratic Party, this caller who has been a lifelong Democrat, has probably was probably disappointed that we didn't fight harder. But there is a balance. You know, corporations need to be able to recoup their investment. We as Democrats, I think most of us believe that they shouldn't get gross windfall profits off of that. And I think what we ultimately ended up was something that allowed them to stay in business, producing power for people of state, but hopefully ease some of the less fortunate into those new rates.
Well, Mike, let me introduce you to our guest and our audience as well. Once again, we are very privileged to have with us Dr. Carol Richards, who's chaplain at Memorial Medical Center in Springfield. And he's been dealing with these values issues for a long, long time. Dr. Richards, you want to join in at this point?
Yeah, Mike, this is Carol. And the caller implied that, you know, there was just some disconnect with things that should be happening. And of course, we all in Illinois are dealing with somewhat dysfunctional state government. How do you respond to the people who say that your values do not seem, you as collective legislature, that your values do not seem to be translated into meaningful action?
Well, the way I would answer that is, even though we're all part of the same party and we share some similar values, Democrats by no means are an autonomous group. I think the Republicans do a much better job of getting in line. We Democrats, we all have different reasons why we became Democrats. We have some things that we share in common. But it is very difficult to get us all together on the same page on an issue.
Mike, what do you anticipate is going – how is the convention going to frame these issues? Do you have any advance notice about how these topics are going to be addressed?
No, I'm not privy to any of that. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know, the party in a presidential year follows the of the president. Mm-hmm. You know, the Democratic Party sets a platform, but really it's the president and to a lesser extent the vice president who go out and present the unified face and present a message. And I think we've got a very competent spokesperson in Barack Obama. He's someone I've known for the last 9 years. Is someone that I've not had a chance to speak too much with over the last couple of years. He's had a fairly meteoric rise to fame. But I've had long conversations about him and what he came from, what his family taught him, what his faith is. And I think that Barack is going to do a great job setting the tone for the Democratic Party this fall.
Dr. Richards, you've had some conversations with Barack Obama in the past, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, I've had a couple of opportunities.
How do you think he's going to handle these values voters issues?
I think Barack is a very thoughtful person, and I certainly think that he does have very core values. He is not always as soundbite as some people would like him to be, and some see that as a negative. I don't personally. I like thoughtful people. But I think he's going to be able to translate. For instance, family values is one term, an issue that always comes up. And I don't see how anyone could better be an example of family values than he and Michelle and their children. You know, they just demonstrate it.
Right. It's my observation, Mike, do you agree that whenever we get on these issues, very often the debate tends to degrade and become uncivil. You have any suggestions for how to, since it looks like it's going to be an ongoing debate in this particular election between now and November, how do we get engaged these issues, these so-called values issues, without becoming uncivil?
Well, I don't know how to keep them from being uncivil, but I do think we need to engage on these. I think in 2004, John Kerry was reluctant to talk about his faith. I'm sorry about this, but there's a fire driving by.
Right.
I think he was reluctant to talk about his faith. I think he was a man of much faith. When you did hear him, you know, it was deeply personal to him, but he didn't want to feel like he was imposing his faith on anyone.
Mm-hmm.
I think Barack has shown, you know, in his speech 4 years ago, he's shown in speeches since then, that he's not afraid to talk about where he comes from. And we shouldn't be, because, you know, we shouldn't let the right define what family values are. Now, since when did, you know, war and tax breaks for the rich equate to family values?
Correct.
But I think we need to say that the reason we're Democrats comes from, many of us, comes from a deep faith. And it's a belief in the teachings of Jesus Christ, and that we should look out for those who are least able to look out for themselves, to those who much have been given, much is expected. These, I think if we can talk about this and assure the general public that we come from a place of morality, we come from a place of faith, then I think we clearly win on economic issues.
Of course, there are Jews and Muslims in the Democratic Party, too.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason why some Democratic candidates are reluctant to talk about their faith. But I think the general public out there doesn't necessarily need you to be of the same faith or the same denomination, but they want to know that you have some sort of grounding and that you're not just pandering and flip-flopping in the wind.
Well, Mike,
so
I know
I think that Jews can respect a Christian of deep faith as many Christians respect Jews of deep faith.
Well, let's hope that these issues emerge in a civil and rational way, and we can avoid some of the nastier sides of this this whole debate between now and November. Mike, I really appreciate you joining us. I know you you have some events to get to. You told me earlier, and your cell phone's barely coming through here. Anything else you want to tell us?
I wish I could be there longer to talk about this. I think it's something that we as Democrats need to do a better job of discussing, because I don't think this is something that one party has complete ownership of. But you've got a great guest in the office, Dr. Richards. I don't think we've talked very much, but you have a son that I think an awful lot of, and he's told me a lot of good things about you. So
I will relay your compliment.
I'm going to let you discuss this issue, and hopefully sometime in the future we'll continue to talk about this, because, Don, I think you are right. We need to have this discussion. It needs to be done in a civil way.
And if between 9 and 6 o'clock you find out who the president of the state senate is going to be, you're going to call in and give us a scoop, right?
I will call back in, but I wouldn't be layering any wages on me finding out in the next 45 minutes.
Well, have a good convention, and take care of yourself.
All right. Thank you very much, Don. You have a great day.
Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. That was Senator Michael Frerichs, who is state senator of Illinois Senate, and he is a delegate to the Democratic Convention in Denver as we speak, which is starting up this week. Well, Dr. Richards, let's try to continue this conversation. Well, we have a couple of guests here. I hope we haven't lost Mike before we get the questions. Hello, you're on line one. This is Keeping the Faith. Your question?
Yes. I had a question to ask. I was asking a question in terms of Biden. Most of us agree that he will enhance Obama as a vice president. Most of us said endorsing Obama. But how do you think his role will fit into this whole idea of the values issue? What do you think he has to offer in terms of the value issue that you guys are currently discussing?
Well, thank you for your question, Dr. Richards. What do you think of Biden on this topic?
Well, the two things that jump to mind on this, one is that he is an observant Roman Catholic, and so he will be able to speak to the values that are common in that tradition. And the other comment would be very similar to the one that I had made earlier about Barack. Part of Mr. Biden's bio is that he has been very careful to nurture the family values. His first wife was killed in an accident, and one of the children, and so he made the decision that he would not live in Washington. He traveled home, commuted, and still to this day commutes from Washington to his home in Delaware each night so he could look after his children. He's now remarried. They have children. And so, again, by example, he's showing that his family is indeed a valuable part of his life.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I think that I understand exactly how that would fit in.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
We have a caller on line two. Hello. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Is this my line?
Yes.
Thank you. Well, I understand Mike Frerichs has left the program.
He has had to take off for a couple of meetings. Sorry.
I see. That's too bad, because I'm doing my best to publicize a local issue here in Champaign-Urbana. Actually, it's one that involves the Chicago and the Collar County areas, too. As some of your listeners may be aware, the Illinois legislature and administration have managed to ditch the scientific surveys, the Illinois State Water Survey, the Illinois State Geological Survey, the Natural History Survey, and I think the museum, too. This is after 30 years of diminishing budgets and a kind of slow strangulation, because I think politicians just are, especially Democratic and Republican administrations, and governors have not been all that attentive to the fact that we have we had for almost 100 years three excellent scientific organizations serving the public. They were places where the ordinary citizen could walk in, email, write in, call in and get a scientific objective answer about whether they had water under their property, oil, gas, or coal, what the insect was that was plaguing their crops, whatever. And now they've been thrown over the side. The University of Illinois is, and the surveys are negotiating a relationship. But my particular concern that has to do with the East Central Illinois and the Northeastern region is the fact that this maneuver has interrupted this third year of a three-year project to study the vital water resources of both areas. In our area that I've been party to working with the committee that's studying the Mahomet Aquifer and the resources of the Sangamon River system, our funding down here is modest. Another 100,000 or 200,000 would have finished a three-year project, as I said, which had completed 2 years. And now this budget crisis and this abandonment of the surveys to find a fate for themselves has interrupted the project, disorganized the geological survey, the water survey, who were doing a part of it. Basically, the program that we hoped to help initiate to find water supplies, to look for the choke points when drought or global climate disruption occurs, has now been thrown off the tracks.
Well,
and this is incredible.
It does sound like a startling issue. Michael Frerix is not with us, and this program is taped and archived. I'll make sure that he gets your question. And
And from a religious point of view, what do you say when the local leadership and the state leadership or the provincial leadership does something that can block the well? I'll even stretch it to get beyond the scientific issues to say this is dealing with the lives, the fortunes of people 10, 20, and 30 years from now. And I just think it's an incredible instance of a reproachable instance of neglect, absence of foresight, and irresponsibility.
Well, I'll make sure Michael gets a question.
But what about the moral side of it?
Well, he's not with us.
Is this a religious question?
Dr. Richard, you want to respond to that at all?
Yeah. Let's hear it from the divines.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think I'm going to pass this on to Michael, and we'll leave it at that. It sounds like you've got a very important topic to pursue.
But nothing we need to talk about from the pulpit.
Well, this is not just the pulpit. This is a focus on values issues across the board. And what this illustrates is that values are much more complex and multi-layered than we tend to get on CNN or Fox. Isn't that right?
There's nothing simpler than water.
There you go.
Or more fundamental. And I don't take complexity and categorizing it as a value issue as an excuse not to talk about it. But good enough. Thank you.
Well, we don't have Michael with us. I'm sorry, sir. All right. Let's move on. Let me just go back a little bit with you, Dr. Richards. I had a wonderful conversation with you, speaking of values. You have had a remarkable history, and as I understand yes, sir.
Could I interrupt just
a
second?
Go right ahead.
Quickly respond to the previous caller. His call and his thoughts do illustrate that values are often in conflict, and simply because I have identified something that it is that is valued to me and to many people around me, which no one would deny, does not mean that it's a value of the same value to everybody, or there may be even conflicting values, and that's just a problem we have in dealing with this whole topic.
Well, thank you for that comment. I think that we certainly should pursue that topic on WLL at some point in the future. Now, you, as I understand it, back in 68, were in seminary. You were at the Memphis Theological Seminary, is that right?
That's correct.
And you had the remarkable opportunity to march with Martin Luther King during the famous march for the garbage workers, the sanitary workers, and you were with him the night or the day before he died, I think you mentioned to us. Is that right?
I was getting ready to go listen to him the night that he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was a first-year student in the spring of 1968 when the sanitation workers went on strike. And there were two black gentlemen who were colleagues of mine in classes who were among the leaders of the black community, which almost always historically has been in the black churches. That was the one place where blacks were allowed leaders. Of course, in those days, Negro was the term that was used. But and so these two gentlemen that I had become acquainted with already found themselves in the middle of the leadership, local leadership, when the workers, sanitation workers, decided to go on strike. And so through them, I was, and with my own interest, why I was able to involve myself in that civil rights issue in that place. And as the spring went on, they were able to bring in Dr. King to lead a march, which, of course, they'd been wanting to do because that would bring national attention to the issue. And so I was a participant in that march. And it's the one that infamously ended in a riot when some of the younger, more angry black gentlemen, men, used the sticks that we were carrying for signs, and they used them instead to break windows of some stores we were going by and proceed to loot and actually just turn into a riot and of course ended the march well short of its destination. And so there were other marches after that, and then Dr. King himself had come back to Memphis in April to lead another march that was they had promised was going to be peaceful. It was going to be done quite differently. And while he was making preparations for that march, which was to be on Monday, he was killed on Friday evening, and, mm-hmm. and I was preparing to go hear him speak. There were nightly rallies, and I had my television news on while I was finishing shaving, actually, and I heard, you know, kind of a commotion that something was out of sorts, and stepped back into my room to hear the news that he had been shot and, of course, eventually died.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on Monday then, instead of the march that he had planned, there was a memorial march for him, which I also was privileged to mm-hmm. be a part of.
Now, that must have been a seminal experience in your life and had a lot to do with how you develop your understanding of what the important values are at the political level. I understand that Martin Luther King Jr. was already making speeches about economic values, not just civil rights issues. Is that right?
He had begun to veer away from what I guess you could call pure civil rights,
mm-hmm.
and he had begun to expand to economics. That's entirely true. He had already begun to talk about the anti-poverty march on Washington, which Ralph Abernathy then organized and led after Dr. King's death. And he was criticized in some quarters because he was, they thought, diluting his influence. He had begun to oppose the war in Vietnam also, which, of course, was another controversial, the other controversial issue of that era. And so it's interesting, speculative, of course, as to what would have happened had he lived and had he been able to engage some of those issues with the backing that he had. But it was certainly certainly a seminal moment in my life. I still consider that one of my proudest moments that I was in that
participated
in that march. It's had an influence, I think, on my family. Mike mentioned my son, whose name is Mike, and I think that's one thing that has spurred him into community services, that he knows that's a value for us, and it was a value. While, you know, psychologists would say, and I would agree, that we never do anything that doesn't in some way benefit us, if not just make us feel better, feel good about it. But basically, it was a value of doing something that benefited me in no way. I had no benefit of helping the black sanitation workers. I had no benefit in raising the ire of white Memphis, which those of us who marched did. It was strictly, I just thought I was at the right place at the right time to be of some help, and so I did. And on one of the occasions that I was able to personally be in conversation with Barack Obama, I was pleased to be able to tell him that there was one thing more that he needed to know about me, and that was that I had marched with Martin Luther King.
This coming Thursday, I believe, is August 28th. Which will be the 40th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, as I understand it.
45th.
45th, right. He will be commemorated, I'm sure, by Barack Obama at Invesco Stadium on that night at the finale for the convention. No one really knows how Dr. King would have evolved over the years and what he would think today, but certainly economic issues, issues having to do with war and civil rights, were the ones that were dear to his heart near the end of his life. And now, for some reason, they seem to be one party's issue. Is that fair to say? How is it that that happened?
Well, of course, that's not true.
It's not true.
I would say. It's not true.
The popular perception.
The popular perception, and it's because of good salesmanship in part, I would say. If you constantly, you start out by saying my values are superior to your values, and then after a while, it evolves into my values are really the only values that matter, and that's sort of where we have arrived. To call the values voter to be interested in, I believe Mike said, abortion, guns, and gays, I think was the phrase that he used, which is basically true. You know, to say that those are the values, of course, is totally incorrect. A value, of course, is simply what is important to us. And they're generally in two categories, what is to the value to the community as a whole or at large, and what other values may be pertain to me individually that may not necessarily pertain to the community as a whole. For instance, one of my values is to try to earn a decent salary, but the whole community really doesn't care what I earn. But in the area of religion, this is actually beginning to change. Most of our listeners, I imagine, are aware that just a week ago, last night, I believe it was, Rick Warren, who is a very famous and popular pastor out on the West Coast in California, Saddleback Church.
Author of The Principle-Driven Life.
Right. He hosted the two presumptive candidates, McCain and Obama, at an event at his church and actually interviewed each of them separately for an hour. But Reverend Warren has been known for at least the last couple of years, maybe more, that he is one, and he is part of people who call themselves evangelicals. But he has begun to, like Dr. King, if I may, he has begun to stray from some of the core beliefs, in the sense that he doesn't deny these values, but he says there are more. And one in particular that he has embraced has been to deal with the issue of HIV and AIDS, particularly in Africa. His wife was especially instrumental in his doing that. And so, like Dr. King, he has been criticized by some that you're diluting. You know, we need to be focused. And but he has been able to go out into some of these other areas and say there are other things that we as Christians need to be interested in and need to be considering, because, for instance, HIV, the issue there is healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so the value of a human life, you know, to be pro-life is to be interested in the life and value of someone's life. And if they have a disease, then to be pro-life is to be interested in their healthcare and the system that provides or doesn't provide their healthcare.
Right. I happen to know that that's one of yours. Let me come back to that in just one second. Let me remind the audience that this is a call-in show, and you can speak with our guest this afternoon, who is Dr. Carol Richards, Reverend Carol Richards. He's the chaplain at Memorial Medical Center, and he's been kind enough to join us along earlier with Michael Frerich, State Senator Michael Frerich, to talk about the issue of values in the contemporary political scene today in light of the upcoming conventions. What are the important values voters issues? And if you would like to call in to give us a question or a comment, the number is 333-9455. You can also call an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, Dr. Richard, you were just talking about healthcare. Why don't we talk a little bit about values issues where the two parties and others can come together? Strikes me one of those is healthcare, and there's another one that Rick Warren didn't mention, and that's the environment. Many evangelicals are moving in that direction. But why don't we talk about healthcare first? Why do you think healthcare is becoming a shared value across the political divide today at all?
Well, it's one that, and I certainly don't speak for either of the parties, and I'm glad I'm sure they're glad to hear me make that disclaimer. I think healthcare is a value issue that we probably all agree with and support. The issue there becomes how do you deliver health care? And generally speaking, the two sides of that issue is one that says, well, you allow the capitalistic system to kick in and let folks compete for the right to give you your health care and to make a profit doing it. And that's sort of the American way.
Privatized competitive model.
Right. The other side then, or at least on the extreme other side, would be, well, we have an obligation as a community, which is to say as a government, to provide health care for everyone, and so we need to do that and control that ourselves, and sort of the socialistic, the Canadian model, sometimes it might be called. And the problem is neither of those are perfect models as they are provided. And so you have the issues of some people who simply, under any guise, cannot afford health care today. And so they don't have health care. And then it impinges on other values. For if a young woman is not able to get prenatal care, her baby may be born with problems or may never even be born because she was not able to get the care. So all of a sudden you move from one value to another one.
Mm-hmm. You're a chaplain and you've seen this for many years. Is the competitive system that you were describing earlier working?
Well, you know, that's not a yes or no answer.
Right.
It works pretty well, but it has some gaps. It works well, of course, if you can just flat out afford the care. It works pretty well if you have insurance. And, of course, it works pretty well for the, I started to say elderly, but I have a Medicare card, too. So shall we just say those who are eligible for Medicare? In other words, if you have someone who can help you pay for it. But the problem is you have a gap of folks that are not able to get health care either because they're not employed or because they're employed in, you know, a whole gamut of reasons.
47 million, they say.
So what you have there are these folks in when they have a serious enough issue, they still come and you know, they come to our facility, they come to the local facilities, and they still get their health care. You know, no one's turned away from the emergency room. And so what happens is they get the same level of care. You know, that's not an issue. But their care then is free in the sense that they can't pay for it, so their care then has to be factored into the corporate structure of the hospital and the doctors and so forth.
Running up costs for others.
Which means, in essence, that when I go in and I'm able to pay my bill, that I'm paying a little bit of their bill too, which then eventually makes the cost, the threshold go up a little higher. So then there's going to be a few more people that can't afford the cost because it's gone up, you know, it just balloons.
I don't know what the numbers are, but there are people who are turned away, aren't there? Famous examples that get broadcast on the media of people who show up and are dumped.
Well, I certainly can't speak to specifics. I've seen of some of those. The law is that anyone with a true emergency has to be seen and receive treatment. A trauma, for instance, that comes into our hospital, they often are there for 30 minutes or an hour before we even have them identified or have identified whether they have any health care. And, you know, nobody even thinks about that. They're wheeled into the trauma room. They're seen by sometimes as many as 8 or 10 doctors within the first few minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of these cases, without knowing specifics, a lot of these cases that have come, there are people that were, there was some doubt as to whether they really had an issue. And there's always folks that are, you know, that are coming up because of other issues that are, you know, that may be looked at in a different light.
And I understand one of the number one causes of bankruptcy is healthcare costs that people can't pay for.
I was a witness to one day where somebody said, this is many, many years ago, and said, well, the good news is you got really good care. The bad news is we now own your farm.
All right. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment?
Yeah, I wanted to comment about how well the capitalistic health care system is working. I'm glad you brought up the bankruptcies, because if it was really working that well, we wouldn't have that many people having to declare bankruptcy because they are not eligible for, they don't have insurance or their insurance isn't sufficient, and they earn too much or are not categorically eligible for Medicaid, and they're not categorically eligible for Medicare, which is over 65 or disabled. I have a son who was on Medicare disability. He's in his 40s, and he had an abscess tooth. This is 2 years ago, and he ended up nearly dying because, of course, Medicare does not cover dental because that's not a medical problem, so they say. And it got to the point where he was able to go into emergency and get some antibiotic because it was starting to affect his whole body. And he ended up being admitted to the hospital, and they took out his gallbladder. And then when they were going to release him the next day, fortunately, the doctor noticed that he wasn't looking right, and he called in somebody else to consult. And they ended up putting him in the ICU, and he ended up being on a ventilator for 8 weeks and in the ICU for 2 months, and then he was in nursing home rehab for like another month. And this was a 46-year-old man because he got severe sepsis in his lungs. Fortunately, it didn't go to his heart or his kidneys, which is usually where you get organ failure. And
I'm beginning to speculate that you've got a fairly big bill.
Yep. It was something like, it was over $700,000.
Right.
And actually his part ended up only being about $7,000. So the taxpayer has, you know, paid for the lack of maybe $1,000 or a few thousand to fix his teeth, because I guess he ended up getting 6 teeth pulled. His wife got dental insurance after that because she's a working person in the family, and they have a child. And he's the house husband, and he's a great dad. But for the lack of a few thousand dollars, it cost $750,000.
Right.
So I would say that was an example of where it's not working that well in the system. I mean, it ended up working for him when it became a medical problem, but the fact that dental isn't covered is a real serious lack.
Well, I want to put a question after our, we have another caller waiting here, but on that particular, with that example, my guess is, Dr. Richards, that where there will be commonality is when the value of health care merges with the economics of health care at some point. Why don't we pick up on that after our other caller here. Hello, you're on line two. You have a question?
Hello, am I on line two?
Yes, ma'am.
I do want to reiterate what the lady mentioned in the prior call. Not only can you become involved in terrible medical issues because you're forced to wait and wait and wait for care that would have been fairly easily remediated had it been done early. But many policies have a $1 million total for the lifetime of a patient. And if you are diagnosed with a very serious illness, that can be taken up in the first 8 or 9 months, maybe prior to that. I mean, when you think of someone ending up with a $700,000 bill for one hospitalization, our health care isn't working at all. So I'd love to hear some input.
Thank you. Dr. Richard, you want to respond to either of those two comments? I think we still have our caller on line one. Is that right? No. Thank you. Dr. Richards?
Right. Well, I certainly am not trying to claim that the system we have is just dandy. The two callers certainly relayed a couple of examples that it isn't. One of the issues, though, and this is another value that's a part of healthcare that we normally don't want to face. When I was in my chaplain training many, many years ago, many decades ago, kidney transplants were new and rare. And so one of the things that I first encountered was the fact that there were meetings once a month where a committee sat down and they took this list of sick people and they decided which one of them got the kidney, which meant the others would more likely die. Now, they had no choice because the kidneys were rare. But that's an issue that continues to be relevant in our healthcare system. And one of the reasons that healthcare is so expensive is that we all want to be treated with the latest imaging equipment, with the latest drugs, so on and so forth. In other words, with the top of the line. Now, all of our lives deserve that. I will certainly agree from the life standpoint. But just from a triage standpoint, it is not possible that we can all receive that level of care.
Or economic.
Or economic. And let's face it, in some cases, we had an example a few weeks ago where without trying to sound untoward, there was a gentleman who had absolutely not taken care of his life in any way for many decades, and then at the end, his family thought that this sophisticated medical community should somehow come in and be able to repair him. So, and that's a multifaceted issue, but it's a value because we value life, but we value all lives.
The issue, I assume, before the Democratic and Republican platform committees will be, yes, we agree with you, but the question is, how do you cause that to happen? With your long experience with health care, do you have some preferences, single payer or a McCain model or a Barack Obama model, or what do you prefer? I'm sure you've thought about this.
Well, my personal preference, from my knowledge, would be a Canadian style with some changes to it. I think that would be the good base. Now, the complaint about it, of course, is that often elective procedures are a long time coming, and so there probably would need now that. The Canadian is not going to happen because our healthcare industry is not going to allow it to happen. But I think we need to begin to educate our public that it's only reasonable. You can't walk into a restaurant and order the lobster and the most expensive champagne just because you would like to have that. And so I think we're going to have to realize that there's some limits on our on triage in our healthcare industry, and we're going to have to nuance our value of life and what it means. Not that life is ever unimportant, but when we have many lives at stake, we have to decide how best to ration the care that we have available.
How would you, if you were talking with an evangelical minister about this, how would you bring them on board to your point of view there? From a religious values perspective, not that values are strictly reduced to religious values.
Well, I would certainly try to begin by affirming the value of all of life, that we are all valuable in and of ourselves and in God's sight. But I think I would probably try to bring on board in the sense that if there are 100 of us out in the desert and we have only one bottle of water and we all get a sip, we will all die.
That's the stark reality, right?
That's the reality. There might be two of us, and I'm, of course, including myself in the us, but there might be two of us who could share that bottle and a half each, and we would be able to get to a place of safety. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like the old lifeboat kind of mm-hmm. ethics. And we have been so fortunate in the United States that we a lot of times haven't had to make these sorts of decisions. But the larger our population gets, the more aged our population gets, we're going to have to make these decisions more and more. And so I would want that evangelical brother of mine to share with me in finding a solution of how can we do the most for the most people with the understanding that we cannot do everything for everybody.
What did Martin Luther King Jr. mean by the beloved community, and how would that relate to what you were just talking about? What would a beloved community in Martin Luther King's description of that term entail for healthcare?
I'm not familiar with what he meant by it, but from what I know of him and what, you know, what it would mean to me is that it would be a community that would understand that sometimes there are sacrifices that have to be made. It's the soldier who throws his body on the grenade so his buddies live. It's the mother who gives her children what food they have so that they can prosper.
Gives their organs for their friends or children, or others in the community, or even strangers in some cases.
But it's that sort of thing. To me, it's, in other words, you care about your community sometimes even more than your own good.
That sounds probably accurate. We have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or comment.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I have a concern about the policy of certain political figures to pledge no tax increase. And so the state of Illinois, which has an embarrassingly small charge for income tax on prosperous people, we're a prosperous state, and we shouldn't be begging off that we shouldn't have taxes in proportion to our prosperity.
That's...
And if there's a humane and compassionate way to regard human life, we really need to pay taxes in order for our country to be strong and to provide the kind of care and services that we need.
That's certainly a values issue that's going to be dividing these two parties, Dr. Richards.
I certainly agree with the caller. The our tax policies and laws reflect our values, and unfortunately they sometimes reflect the values of the haves at the expense of the have-nots. But it's also a complicated one because economists would tell us that, you know, at a certain level of taxation, you begin to have diminished returns. And so.
Well, we have only about 60 seconds, Dr. Richards. You mentioned health care. We haven't had a chance to talk about the environment. Are there other issues where values voters on both sides of the aisle can come together, just very, very briefly, that you can think of?
Well, the certainly economics is one that I had in mind. Our tax structure, immigration policy is one that's very much in the fore and going to be at the. And there again, we have the issue of law abiding, but then we also have the issues that our immigration policy is concocted by people that for our best interest.
Well, thank you for being with us, Dr. Carol Richards, chaplain at Memorial Center Medical Center in Springfield, Illinois. We also had Senator Mike Frericks on Keeping the Faith today. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your questions. This is Don Nolan. See you again next week. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Years ago, the streets of Chicago exploded as police clashed with protesters at the Democratic National Convention, an event that defined the 60s. Or is it? Some historians now say the rise of the conservative movement is what truly made history. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll dissect the 60s. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7. Every 4 years, Democrats and Republicans gather to nominate their candidates for president. This year, Senators Barack Obama and John McCain will accept their party's nominations. Join us for special coverage of the 2008 conventions from NPR News, beginning August 25th.
WILL programs are funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, performing computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventive maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service is also available. More information is available at 344-0800.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.